Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
The blood washed away, but the guilt never does. Welcome to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring psychotherapist and author Siobhan Scott.
Ever go to a movie like halfway in? I remember doing this like as a kid when we would sneak into the movie after the movie to get two movies for the price of one. And sometimes you get into one and it's like halfway done and you're very confused because you sometimes don't know who like the protagonist is, who the villain is, who the savior is, who the hero. It's all messed up. And then as movies end, sometimes bad guy wins, sometimes you just don't know. You don't know who ends up winning at the end of the story. So it's hard to walk out of that movie and say, here's what I thought of it. Let me give you a rundown. Let me explain this to you. That's kind of what happened in the trial of Richard Allen. The jurors only got to see part of the movie, the part that Judge Gull wanted them to see, which also happens to be pretty much in line with the same thing the Delphi police investigators wanted everyone to see. They were kind of on the same page of what we wanted or what they wanted the jury to see in the trial of Richard Allen. And the conclusion they came to, based on this very limited scope of information, guilty. I guess based on that, not very surprising. Does it reflect reality? That's the question. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, joining us to discuss this. I was surprised. How about you?
Yeah, I was actually shocked because after hearing all the evidence, you know, I didn't know till we had gone through the trial. And even though we weren't able to have cameras in the courtroom, I think there were some remarkable reporters in the courtroom who brought us play by play everything that had been admitted into evidence. For me, the fact that a man with the kind of psychotic mental break that he had certainly raised reasonable doubt about those confessions. And it seemed like the jury just went with the confessions without any consideration for the fact that the guy was not even in reality when he was saying those things. So I was very surprised.
What does that say about, I guess, the general public as a whole? You know, obviously there's plenty of people out there who understand mental health conditions and, you know, different states of mind for different situations. But the jury of your peers, it's just a slice, you know, supposedly of the general public. So we're just going to kind of speak on those terms. What does it say about our understanding of mental health conditions? I mean, this is a pretty obvious one. I mean, if the guy eating the Bible and his poop and running into a wall head first and then intermittently saying, I killed them, isn't enough to make an average person go, there might be something wrong with that guy. I'm not quite sure what is.
Yeah, it's shocking to me. And I, of course, find all the time people who don't understand what psychosis means, you know, because we throw the word around a lot. Oh, he's a psycho or she's a psycho, you know, and so we tend to think it means just somebody who's sort of out of control or somebody who's not very well put together. Mm-hmm. But it actually means, psychosis actually means a complete break with reality. So they often don't know who they are. They don't know where they are. They don't know what's true, what isn't true. And it's a brain condition. It's an illness. And it's, you know, the brain is an organ in the body, just like any other organ. It can become diseased. And the psychotic condition simply means that you can't trust what anybody says when they're in that state.
Mm-hmm. It's an analogy I just came up with because I always like making analogies. It's like operating your computer in safe mode, where it's like, okay, we see in the background all of these pieces of the individual are there, but you can't access them at that point in time. Mm-hmm. The computer is running. It can run, but it's just running on the very basics of it's aware of its surroundings. It can hear, it can talk, it can taste, it can do those sort of things. But the coding, the programs and everything that make that computer what it is, the things that it can execute, can't access them at that point in time. They're there, but cannot be accessed. It looks like the computer you just had, but it's in safe mode. And that's kind of, I'd almost say, like what someone in that state or maybe other states too could be analogized into as far as, look, yeah, this person is, it's in there, it's not coming out, and they're not reading it right now. And that's, you're just getting a very surface level thing of really not a complete picture of who that human being is. And they're not going to make the right decisions other than, I mean, not even quite for survival sometimes either.
Right. Yeah, definitely not. And I've had clients who didn't even believe they were human anymore. One guy believed he was a robot. Another guy believed he was Godzilla. It's common for people to be hallucinating and believe that they're a celebrity. I had one person who believed he was JFK. And I mean, this is truly what their brain is telling them at that point. So how can you take anything that comes out of a psychotic person's mouth as the truth? You know, you just can't.
Why is it that, I mean, in this case, for example, we had one, the prison psychologist who obviously had a lot of, you know, marks against her for basically trying to exploit this trial for her own gain with podcasts and such. And then you have another mental health expert who came in and said, yeah, there's something not right with him. He was psychotic. The prison one saying, no, I don't think he was. Is that just really just poor work? Is that just being a very inept clinician? I mean, what is that where you can have two people who are supposedly, you know, experts in this area having such varying opinions on something like a Richard Allen? I mean, this is kind of black and white, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah. I try to be hesitant about criticizing other clinicians, you know, publicly, but frankly, there are some that just aren't very good. And I also think that you see in the, forensic in the criminal settings, often you may run into people who have a bias. And because in prisons, they do often see people who are malingering or feigning illnesses mm-hmm. in order to get some kind of special treatment or benefits. I think they can look at everybody with a bit more of a jaded eye, assuming that people are faking when they start exhibiting these kind of symptoms. But from everything that was documented that came out in the trial, I don't see how that was a reasonable stand to take. And I think she was wrong.
In the case of Richard Allen, the jury seemed to take the side of, well, he must have been faking it. That's certainly what the prosecution wanted everyone to believe. They had their psychologists come on the stand, the prison doctor, and talked about all that. She believed he was competent. The expert that came in for Richard Allen, not remotely saying the same thing. Let's talk about faking it. Obviously, when you're behind bars, there probably is a lot of feigning. There probably is a lot of people who are trying to fake it so they can get moved to another facility or whatever their goal may be. How easy is it? How difficult, I should ask you, is it to recognize when someone is feigning versus not?
It can be difficult, and you really do have to spend time with people. One of the things that you look for is the behavior, if it's psychotic appearing behavior, depression or whatever, is it consistent over time or does it come and go? You know, obviously a person that's consistently mentally ill, that carries more weight than somebody who seems to have just these transitory symptoms. But you also look for the severity of it. And I think the thing that really tipped the, you know, the evidence for me was the self-injury, the degree that he was banging his head on the wall. And then, of course, the eating feces, as I've said many times. I've never seen anybody feign by doing that, although it is something that sometimes people in a severe state of psychosis will do. And so I think it's something you have to spend time with. You have to look at the person consistently. And then, of course, as we've talked about, there are tests that you can give. You know, you can give more in-depth psychological tests that a person who's feigning, it will show up in a certain specific pattern and versus when a person is legitimately ill.
You know, they had all this time to try and figure out the answers to this question. Why did it seem so difficult to do that, in your opinion, in this case? Did they just not want to go down the roads to get the answers that would truly define what is going on? Because maybe the assumptions where they're left are more in play for a certain verdict versus not?
Yeah, it's very frustrating to me whenever I see professionals that don't seem to go the extra mile, you know, to get the right kind of information that they should have. And that's what it looks like to me, is that they just didn't bother. And if they didn't bother in this case, how many other cases are there where they just don't bother to find out what's really going on with someone? So it's very troubling.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of connection or... not necessarily connection, but I guess weight. The weight that those of us outside the criminal justice system put on mental health versus the criminal justice system itself. There seems to still be quite a big disconnect in understanding what certain things can do to people and how it drives behavior and ultimately drives behavior towards some of the crimes that we talk about. Is that an accurate observation?
Yeah. It's very poorly understood. And we like to think that when you have people who work in institutions that they're paying more attention to it, but clearly sometimes they're not. I've seen it a lot also with people in the military, because often it's another case I'm thinking of with someone I was involved with some years back, but a young man became psychotic during boot camp. And they called it, he's playing crazy. And he became increasingly ill and increasingly psychotic. And by the time I came in to the situation, he had to be in 4-point restraints, held down in a hospital bed with a guard with a gun standing over him, which is not exactly a therapeutic situation. And it could have been caught early and he could have been given some medication. And obviously the military was not the right place for him. But the fact that they could not see this and that they had some degree of mental health staff who didn't understand what was going on either is really scary. So prisons, military, probably a lot of places in our different governmental institutions, it's not well understood and not treated.
I mean, it almost feels like they put people into these positions where it's like, they're good enough for what we want them mm-hmm. to be. They don't know above this level, but above this level could actually backfire at us. So we're just going to keep them here. And it can keep reinforcing our previous beliefs or misunderstandings of mental health. It seems like a dig in thing to me, where it's like, well, this is how we've done it. This is what we believe. And, you know, I'm going to just keep going because that's how it's always been.
Yeah, very true. And how to make the system move ahead and despite the harm that may be coming to people who are caught up in it in some way.
What about Richard Allen himself after going through this? And let's assume, as I believe, you know, yeah, he went into a psychotic state and everything that he was doing, from the running headfirst into the wall to eating his own feces to, you know, having lunch, you know, eating Leviticus, literally the Bible. When you have that and you come out of it, are you ever the same person again, or does that do some sort of irreparable, you know, damage or rewiring of the brain that you come out of the other side? I don't know. I mean, is there a difference in the person, or can the person be completely the same as they were prior?
It can go both ways. Certainly looking at him, the little bit of time that we see him on camera, he does not look like a well man at all. He doesn't look like the man who was arrested at all anymore. So can, with the right medication and treatment and the right environment, could he come back to be essentially the same person he was before? It's possible, but it also wouldn't surprise me if he was left a bit of a shell of his normal self as well.
Sure. Let's talk about the actual investigation. Let's talk about how the court has handled this, Judge Frances Gull and her many rulings in this case. And I'm just trying to get a grasp on what is going on here. I mean, if we're going to assume there's nothing that's being covered up necessarily in terms of him having a connection or the actual murderer being somebody else that they all know and they're covering for. But I'm saying more so in the lines of bad police work, bad investigation. the community wants someone to blame for this, and seemed Judge Gull just, you know, wanted to ram this through in any way that was needed, and didn't really take a lot of time to consider a lot of these factors. I mean, firing his attorneys at one point, really narrowing down the possibilities of what they could even argue in court. What's going on there? What's going on in that sort of environment where you got the judge that's kind of thinking this one way, you got the community, the law enforcement that's pretty much on the same page, and it's just all this group think of, okay, this is our case, this is what we're going to do. And it just seemed reality and common sense were left out of the equation in all of the motions leading up to this actual trial. And the thing is, that's where most of the big decisions are made, is in the motions leading up to a trial.
Yeah, it's really surprising and scary, isn't it? And it, none of it, as we've said for so long, it smells fishy. None of it has appeared to be transparent. And it just makes me wonder how many other cases are there like this, where somebody is just basically railroaded and the system is not working the way that we think it's supposed to.
I mean, is this something that you think commonly goes on in jurisdictions where you kind of got the city basically, you know, against the defendant, and there's no way that they're ever going to look at it fairly? I mean, that's the thing. Like we weren't nobody's even arguing, I think, for the most part, or saying Richard Allen is innocent. Everyone's just saying, look, this is not a fair playing field to even determine that question.
Yeah, it seems like there should be a lot more protest than there is about it, just from what we know, what we've been able to see. It doesn't look right.
The family of Libby and Abby, obviously there is a verdict now. It's sure going to be appealed. Closure, I mean, that's a funny word. It's often, I think, used by people who haven't been through the trauma. And like, oh, we'll find a way to move on. Like, you never move on from something like your kids being murdered and not knowing who did it. I mean, justice is the only thing, I think, in many people's mind where you can maybe kind of start to move forward, move on a little bit while still living with that pain. How do you think they're coping with this? I'm not trying to put words in their mouth, but yeah, they got a verdict, but I mean, they're not deaf. They're not immune to what the general population is saying, who also want justice for these kids.
Yeah, I wish there was some way to say, yes, people get closure and feel better. I don't know that this verdict would do it. And you know, not knowing them, I don't believe I've seen recent interviews with them since the verdict has come out. Yeah. So I don't know if they feel that they're any better off than they were before. It certainly doesn't look like it.
There's been some cases in the past where the victims' families don't agree with the verdict, and they don't agree with the guilty verdict, and they come out and they challenge the system as well, because they want to find what's going on. I'm not saying that that's their opinion. I don't know their opinion right now. But just for, I guess, talking on a psychological basis and on a mental health basis, if you are in that situation, if you are a parent, and let's just, for the sake of everything, you say maybe somebody's in that boat on in that family that goes, yeah, we got somebody here, but I don't think it's them. What is a healthy path to go forward on in something like this? Is it to continue, you know, divulging yourself into the story and diving into it and surrounding yourself with it and the sadness and the depression that would bring on, you know, by continuing to fight for what you think is right to find justice? Or is there a time sometimes where, you know, as a clinician, you just say, look, you know, there's other people to fight this for you mentally going forward. Just, you know, try and disconnect from the drama, from all these things that are going on and things that you really can't control.
Yeah, I think everybody has a unique path with that sort of thing. And I always encourage people to take really good care of themselves, including their mental health, and have a balanced life. And if they feel like they still need to do something you know, in some way to follow through a good fight in their mind, then you can do that, but you have to compartmentalize it and not make it the entirety of your existence. You still need love in your life. You need joy. You need, you know, good self-care. You need to have hobbies, interests, a career. And then if you still need to pursue justice in whatever way you do it, but do all those other things as well.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
You're in the thick of a true crime saga, every detail sinking in. And then, wham, a commercial about something you couldn't care less about. It's like being served a microwaved dinner at a five-star restaurant. But it doesn't have to be this way. Go for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. With True Crime Today Premium Plus, you get uninterrupted, ad-free episodes, extended interviews that dig even deeper into the muck, and early access so you can brag to your friends. It's like ordering the secret menu at a crime buffet. So, search for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and savor every twisted detail without interruption.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.